Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Think your high credit card fees are criminal? Maybe it's time to run those bandits out of town.
The credit card industry has really, literally been a Wild West frontier.
Out here, a man settles his own problems. Meanwhile, wondering if people still mail gifts in a down economy? How about a UPS indicator?
We're going to be going to about 350 stops a day. My normal day is about 100 to 110 stops a day.
Plus, we'll meet one family the UPS driver will not be visiting this year. No gifts for them this Christmas. They're finding free ways to give to each other instead.
If you start celebrating Christmas this way, just think of the money you would save.
That story and more of our continuing coverage of fallout from the financial crisis. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Don't know about you, but one tough lesson I've learned from this financial crisis is that I'm pretty much on my own. I can't count on brokers or regulators or bankers or any of their ilk to look out for my interests. The crowning touch? It took years for anyone to uncover a $50 billion Wall Street Ponzi scheme. Good grief. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
We'll get to the Bernie Madoff case in a moment, but first some good news on the credit card front. This week, federal regulators rolled out the biggest overhaul the credit card industry has seen in decades. You know why this was necessary. Those sudden spikes in your interest rate, new fees you don't know about unless you spend your free time reading the fine print. The list goes on and on of ways the credit card companies ding us. Ashley Millen-Tite reports on what the new guidelines mean for those of us who use plastic.
Bill Riley owns two computer repair shops in Rhode Island and Massachusetts. Last year, he bought a piece of equipment on one of his credit cards.
And it was a card that had been empty for almost 2 years, and it had a 12.9% rate. I made this purchase that used about a third of the available credit, and when I received the first statement with that purchase on it, my rate had gone to 24%.
He paid it off as fast as he could. Then he shut down the card. Tony Troutman of California is just as exasperated with one of his card companies, a major player in the industry. Several years ago, he took out a cash advance with the company. Troutman says he knew they charged higher interest rates for a cash advance, but he didn't pick up on something else until recently.
But what I just realized is that all the interest they're charging me on the cash advance is being added to the balance on the cash advance, so I'm paying compounded interest. Because all my payments are being credited to my normal purchases first.
He says this billing tactic is a sneaky trick that just keeps him in debt longer than necessary. Robert Manning directs the Center for Consumer Financial Services at the Rochester Institute of Technology. He says it's about time credit card companies were brought to heel.
The credit card industry has really, literally been a Wild West frontier over the last 10 years as federal regulators have increasingly turned their attention elsewhere.
Now, after thousands of consumer complaints, their attention has shifted. Travis Plunkett is legislative director of the Consumer Federation of America. He says the changes regulators announced this week should save consumers money and confusion.
First and foremost, the credit card companies aren't going to be able to arbitrarily increase your interest rate on your existing balance unless you are truly in arrears, that is, unless you're 30 days late in paying.
And they'll have to give you 45 days notice before changing your interest rate. Another consumer gripe should also be less common. Bill Riley says he's sometimes dinged with late fees because there's little time between receiving his bill and its due date. And he's noticed many of the due dates seem to fall on weekends or holidays.
Which presents more opportunity to be late. You pay additional fees, and then you can have your rate increased, and another creditor sees that on your report, and then your rate goes up there, and it's a feedback loop.
Under the new rules, companies must give customers at least 21 days to pay. It all sounds like good news for consumers, but there's a catch. The rules don't go into effect until July of 2010. Travis Plunkett says the changes are needed now since more people are behind on their credit card payments today than at any time since 2002.
And more people are defaulting on their credit card bills, and that is only going to increase in the next year or two. Now is when consumers really need this help.
Regulators say financial institutions need the next year and a half to comply. They had pushed for longer. But Robert Manning says the changes don't go far enough.
My concern, of course, is that what we really need is for Congress to pass and codify these changes into an act of law so that there isn't ambiguity among the different regulatory branches and how they would enforce and penalize those who violated these new rules.
The Credit Card Holders Bill of Rights passed the House in the fall, but has languished in the Senate. Manning and others hope the new Congress will take up the issue again next year. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
Imagine your life savings wiped out in an instant, or your favorite charity forced to close its doors because endowment money vaporized. That happened all over the country this week as investors in Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities scrambled to assess their exposure to his alleged $50 billion Ponzi scheme. So many people, smart people, were duped for years that you gotta wonder how you're supposed to avoid the same fate. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is here with some pointers. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Tess.
So is there a way to identify a Ponzi scheme up front?
Besides it being named Ponzi Incorporated, right?
Right. Or now Madoff Incorporated, I suppose, would be a clue as well.
Right. And of course, one of the things to note is they often sound like legitimate businesses. But there are a few characteristics of Ponzi schemes that are very obvious and identifiable if you step back from actually hoping to make money on them and look at them sort of square in the eye. Number one, they promise very high returns and very regular returns, sometimes 25% over 90 days or, you know, 40% over a year. And they keep delivering those returns in good times and bad, or at least they tell you you've earned your money on paper, and almost no investment delivers so reliably.
Well, we're talking about timelines of 90 days, maybe 6 months, maybe a year, but this Madoff alleged Ponzi scheme went on for years and years and years. How was it different?
In some ways, you know, at its core, the mathematics of it probably weren't that different from any Ponzi scheme. I'm kind of thinking of this as sort of Ponzi 2.0 or Ponzi on steroids. It was very sophisticated, you know, multiple sets of books, trades not being done here but being done in Europe allegedly, people getting statements that were sort of hard to read but really indicated that trading was going on. And that does make it presumably harder even if you're very savvy to see what may be underlying it.
Well, let me then pose a question that came in from a listener this week. And I really think it's the question out of this case, which is, if folks involved on Wall Street can't figure out the validity of an investment, if regulators can't figure it out, what possible chance do the rest of us have?
Well, an investor should ask themselves, is this so good that it's probably too good to be true? And if it seems as if it is, there well may be something wrong.
And that's a lot of the red flags that you already talked about.
Right, exactly. The guaranteed returns, the very high returns.
Yeah.
But if you can't understand or don't know what the strategy is, it's best to stay away from it. Let people who think they understand it risk their money on it. And finally, don't invest with someone who doesn't have a proven track record, a name that's known, and especially books that are open to the proper regulatory authorities to look to see that the assets are really there, that they're really being traded, and that the returns that are reported are really happening.
All right. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for our audio op-ed, The Straight Story, and with us, as always, is our very own Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess, and what would you like to talk about today?
I think we have to talk about the Federal Reserve, my friend.
History in the making.
Yeah, truly. We are down basically almost at zero for the benchmark interest rate, and this is a record.
No, we have all these superlatives we can associate with interest rates. So you have a 0% Fed funds rate. Well, you basically have a 0% 3-month Treasury bill. The 10-year Treasury bond is just barely above 2%. This is just a phenomenon.
So why did the Fed feel the need to do this? What is the point of lowering interest rates so far?
The Fed is desperate to get this economy going again, which that really means to get borrowing and lending going again, because this economy lives on credit. And what the Fed is trying to do is bring down overall interest rates to a level where people are going to be more comfortable to start borrowing and lending. And they've made it very clear that cutting their benchmark interest rate to zero, I know it says 0 to 0.25 percentage point. Let's just use the word zero, because that's really what we're talking about. All right, let's get real here. It's zero. So going to zero with the benchmark interest rate is part of that. As you saw this week, the prime rate was cut. A number of other interest rates came down. And then, I'm paraphrasing here in a way, but you know, it's like Ben Bernanke is pretending that he is Franklin D. Roosevelt. He'll do anything and whatever it takes to get the economy going. He's going to experiment. Zero is only part of the arsenal.
But how much good is this really going to do? I mean, so far, we have not seen a raft of lending since the Fed came out with this announcement on Tuesday. And that was kind of the whole point of it, was to get banks lending again. So now that the rate is at zero, what do they do?
Well, in defense of the Fed, one thing that they're saying, and I do think this is true, if they hadn't done what they've done, think how bad off the economy would be. Now what I think they're going to do is shift to the long end of the market. So they're going to start buying. In fact, they have been buying the corporate debt of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, mortgage-backed securities. They'll probably be buying treasury bonds, all in an attempt to bring down the long-term interest rate. And Tess, we are starting to see in our emails and some of the questions that we've been getting, queries about refinancing that mortgage, the sense that maybe I can refinance myself a little bit out of trouble, that's growing. This is what the Fed is trying to do. And what I really believe what they're trying to do is buy time until we get the big fiscal stimulus package, which keeps growing in size. The latest figure that I saw was $850 billion.
I suppose we should also note that there is a downside to such low interest rates, and that's for anyone who's trying to save. Can you get a return anywhere anymore?
No, you can't.
Yeah, there you go. No.
You can do a little bit better than Treasury bills. Go into a certificate of deposit. Under $250,000, FDIC-insured institution or its equivalent with a credit union. But fact of the matter is, you need safety. You need to preserve that principal. You're going to make very little interest.
I guess we've gotten to the point where just getting 0% return on your money is better than losing all of it. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
With layoffs and bailouts abounding, some business majors wonder, is it too late to change paths?
For them to switch majors all of a sudden could actually imply that they're going to have to be in school longer. So it's not something that they can just easily make that jump.
That story plus answers to your finance questions. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Most students are on holiday break at this point. No more studying till January. Undergrad and MBA programs crank out thousands of fresh investment bankers with each graduating class. But at a time when investment bankers face a job market about as secure as medieval puppetry, we wondered if business schools might be facing a crisis of their own. Sally Herships has that story.
One upside of the market meltdown is it's a perfect time to teach business students about the ins and outs of finance. Jerry Langley has been a professor at Mendoza, Notre Dame's business school, for 10 years.
The textbook became the Wall Street Journal every day almost. On Wednesday, I would say, okay, what's happened in the news since Monday? It used to be, you know, what happened last month. Now it's every day. Every day, the current events provided, 15, 20 minutes of discussion right at the beginning of class.
Langley says the news provides good fodder for students to chew on, but it scares them too. They know that careers in investment banking are becoming scarce. More than 100,000 students graduate with an MBA each year, so competition is intense. Patrick Perella works at Mendoza, too. He says despite the job market for MBAs, he's not seeing anyone changing careers midstream.
For them to switch majors all of a sudden could actually imply that they're going to have to be in school longer. So it's not something that they can just easily make that jump.
Colleges are just as aware of the challenges this meltdown has created. So Perella says they're focusing on ensuring students have realistic career aims. And sometimes that means dialing back their expectations.
You might not get your dream job coming out of MBA now. It might be the job that you expected to get when you first came in and got your MBA. But make sure it's a job that at least gets you in the right direction.
Administrators say reality hasn't bitten quite so hard on the undergrad campuses. Business students are still coming to school in suits and ties the way they did during the boom years. Sally Blount-Lyon is dean at Stern, NYU's business school. She says around a quarter of undergrads declared business as their major over the last few decades, and this year it's still one of the most popular choices. But she says that's okay because there's more to business school than investment banking.
You know, one of the things we joke about, the accountants have jobs. With Sarbanes-Oxley and what's going on, there will be jobs in accounting.
And accounting looks like an increasingly popular choice at Stern. Richard Barbier is an undergrad senior there. He says a lot of his friends are looking into accounting and law and away from the financial sector. Barbier has a job lined up in consulting. He got lucky early on.
You're seeing a lot of people out there who are going to as many different job interviews, as many different opportunities as possible. It doesn't even have to be a field that they're particularly passionate about. They just want to know, all right, when I graduate, I will be doing something.
Students with that mindset could find themselves in a similar situation to Charmian Stone. I met her in New York's financial district during her dinner break. She told me after college she spent 3.5 years at grad school. Now she has a JD and an MBA.
So you're quite educated.
I'd like to think so, but it's tough when I'm not getting any jobs or job offers. It's disheartening because it's like, I know I can do this.
Stone works on Wall Street, but it's not quite the job she dreamed of. She's a legal temp. She wants to be an investment banker. She was interviewing for jobs when the investment banks began to fail. Offers on 2 jobs fell through.
And now I'm settling for jobs just to pay the bills, and I'm working 60 hours a week, basically clocking in punch card-wise and paid by the hour, and that's not what I imagined to be doing it after getting 2 advanced degrees.
Wall Street is full of stories like Charmian Stone's these days. But at NYU Stern, Sally Blount-Lyon says she doesn't think that will dissuade prospective business students.
Business is the dominant social institution of our time. Just because Wall Street is unraveling doesn't mean that we still don't have goods and services and life doesn't go on every day.
Blount-Lyon says applications for places at Stern this year were up 16%. For big firms, a down market means cuts in jobs and budgets. B schools are hoping for them it means more students. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Marketplace Money is supported by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
All right, let's go from thinking about starting a new career to thinking about how to end the one you're in now. At this point, lots of us have abandoned the idea that once you hit retirement age, the only thing you have to worry about is your golf game. Nowadays, you really have to plan to keep money coming in, no matter how old you are. And that's the thinking behind something called a retirement income fund. Bob Frick is a senior editor at Kiplinger's magazine. And Bob, first, what are these funds supposed to do?
They're kind of the reverse of target date funds, but instead of putting money in regularly, they are going to pay you money out on a monthly basis. So you're retired, you want steady income, you sock your money in one of these, and they basically dole it back to you after investing it well, you know, a month at a time.
What is the advantage, if any, of retirement income funds or disadvantage over other investment options?
Well, I think the advantages are it's a diversified portfolio. And you know, that sounds simple, but you also know most people don't use them.
Right.
And a diversified portfolio is magic. It's the only free lunch you get in investing. So most people are going to be a quantum leap ahead in their retirement investing if they're simply diversified. And that goes a long way.
So who would this be good for? Just your average investor? Anybody? Any age?
I think it's good for people who need to be kind of on a budget, because if you're really good at investing and have discipline, and few of us are, these funds provide the discipline for you. So let's say, you know, you're 65, you're 70, you're retired, you've got your nest egg, you want it paid back to you in a disciplined way and invested in a good portfolio, then these are fine for you. The problem is all things started right when the bear market started a year ago. So it's the timing could not be worse.
So this is something that you get into once you have retired. It's not something that you're going to want to invest in as a 25-year-old.
No, absolutely not. Target date funds, we like. Again, those are diversified portfolios. These are diversified portfolios, but they pay you back. You don't want to invest in these to grow your nest egg. You want to invest in these to shrink your nest egg.
So based on what you've said about retirement income funds, it sounds like they are invested in a mix of stocks, bonds?
Exactly. Stocks, bonds, you know, overseas, domestic, small cap, big cap, and we love that. The thing that people have to realize is if the market tanks, you have to, you know, renegotiate your retirement. You have to stop taking money out. You got to work longer. You got to do something to make your money last longer.
But why is that? Explain for us how the amount of the payout is determined. Because I think that's what you're talking about here, right?
Right,
exactly. The market is somehow determining what your payout is.
Right. So let me just speak generically. We've had a lousy year. Well, that's not generic. That's the truth. We've had a lousy year in the stock market. At the end of this year, they're going to look at the assets in these funds, and they're going to determine based on that basically what the payout is going to be. Now, they're going to make a promise up front that the payout, say, is going to be, let's say, 7% per year, you know, which is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, though, if the market tanks? Now, all of a sudden, you're going to be getting your 7% back, but it's going to be 7% of a smaller nest egg. So your payment's going to go down. On the other hand, what if the market, you know, as we all hope, rebounds, you know, it's up 30% next year or something, then all of a sudden your payout is going to be more, but also your nest egg will have grown, and that'll make you sleep better at night.
Okay. Bob Frick is senior editor at Kiplinger's Magazine. Thanks so much for coming in.
You're so welcome.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we focus on your questions. And with me once again is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess. And so you got some questions for me, huh?
We do, you know, surprise, surprise.
All right.
Well, we're going to start with a question that lots of people may have been wondering over the last few months with all the news of, you know, crisis, fallout.
What crisis?
Right. I wish. That is just the point here. What name do we give to what is going on in the world of money? Afia wrote in asking us to help her understand the difference between two words. And this may seem very basic, but it's an excellent question. Financial and economic.
It is a good question. Now, Afia, part of it is journalists when we're talking or we're writing, and we just can't use the word economy, economy, economy. We can't just use the word financial, financial, financial. So we do tend to mix them up just to give a little variety, and they're both broad words. But there is a basic distinction. Financial is stocks, bonds, commodities, financial institutions, brokerage, hedge funds. So it's everything
Wall
that has
Street.
To do with money. It's Wall Street writ large. That's one way to think about it. And then the economy, that's employment, jobs, the production of goods, offering services, walking down Main Street. This is your economy. Now, the reason why we tend to sometimes mix them together is just what we're living through right now. When the stock market goes down by, about 40%?
That has don't remind me.
Real implications for whether companies start laying off people, with an unemployment rate now at 6.7%. So they're clearly related, but they are slightly different spheres of this global economy we live in. And I just tossed that one in there just to even so we have the global economy and the global financial markets.
Exactly. All right. Thank you, Professor.
Yes, and you get an A for asking a very good question.
Excellent, excellent. Well, next we have Scott on the phone, and he's in Blanchester, Ohio. Hi, Scott.
How do you do?
What's your question for us?
Well, my son is currently in college, and he's a little loose with his money, and we've had to cover him several times on various things. And we were thinking seriously about giving him a sort of a dose of tough love, but we're wondering if that can come around and bite us in our credit standing, because I'm a co-signer on a couple of his student loans. My wife is a co-signer on his car loan, and she's also on his checking account to make it easier for her to transfer money when necessary. So we were wondering if he does, you know, miss a payment or default on something, how will that affect us?
What's your definition of tough love here? Would that basically mean that you're not helping him out at all?
Well, not totally helping him out, but I mean, when he calls at 10 o'clock at night and says, I need money by 8 o'clock tomorrow, it gets a little irritating.
Ooh, that would.
Yeah.
That really would. When you're a co-signer, you are at risk. And in the environment that we're in, no lender is going to let you drop off. They're going to want that security.
I understand that.
So first thing we do is get your wife off the checking account.
All right.
I think that's very easy. In terms of the car, does he really need it?
Actually, he does. He's out of state and uses it to get back and forth, and he lives off campus, so he does need it to get to commute to campus.
Just trying to think of something concrete we can do without totally getting into a disruptive situation. You know, say, you know what, you're going to have to live on campus, and we're taking the car back, because the fact of the matter is, we're at risk if you don't make these payments. So live on campus, you don't have a car. If you're living on campus, rent becomes less of an issue, right?
That's very true.
You'll pay that up front, and if he wants to be living off campus, because that's the kind of lifestyle that he wants to have while he's in college, he has to earn it.
I like it.
You know, he is your son, and you love him, and you don't want to, you know, we don't want to toss him out on the street. The other thing is, you know, perhaps you go there, perhaps he comes home, but at the beginning of every semester, you lay out what the budget is, because you know what? In a, what, year or two, he's going to be off on his own.
Scott, is this something where you've really sat him down and had a serious conversation with him about this?
We've tried. He kind of blows us off continually. That's why I was thinking more in terms of letting something like this happen, like the lights go out all of a sudden or something along those lines, where he's, you know, forced to say, oh, geez, this is going to happen.
What is he, 20?
Yes, he is.
He's 20 years old. What I would do is put him back on the university, you know, where you have a lot more control. If then he's still not paying attention to you, we have the risk of whatever, however many student loans he's taken out at that point. You know, you'll continue to accept that risk. But other than that, that's the only risk you got.
All right. Thank you.
Well, good luck. It's a tough situation. I guess sometimes tough love is the only way to go.
Sometimes it is. Thank you.
All right. Best of luck. Well, if you could use a few financial lessons of your own, do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or send us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And Chris will be back for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. If you waited until now to order gifts online or mail them from home to friends and family, well, the next few days are not about the chimney or the tree. They're all about the doorbell. Will those boxes arrive on time? Will everything be in one piece? Will that old-time popcorn machine look as cool as it did in Sky Mall? On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we take a tour with one of Santa's helpers, one who wears brown polyester, and takes a lot of care to ensure those bundles of joy get to you on time, intact. And he says this holiday season is busy as ever.
Hey, Jim. How you doing?
My name is Fred Gorley. I'm a package car driver, and I've been employed with UPS for 25 years.
Got a phone call this morning that you were on your way. They narrowed it down to sometime between 8 and 6.
We're getting better. Used to be 8 and 10, wasn't it?
An average day during the Christmas season, my day starts about 7:30 in the morning. It can end anywhere from 7 to 8 o'clock at night. At peak, we're going to be going to about 350 stops a day. My normal day is about 100 to 110 stops a day. By far, the holiday season is my least favorite time of the year. When everybody's having a good time, our calendar is closed. There's no vacation time allowed. There's no floating holidays allowed. There's no personal days to be taken because we need the manpower. Most UPS drivers, we don't like to sit in traffic because we need to get out to route and start our route as quick as possible. So we know all the surface streets. We know all the side streets. There's pretty much nothing out here area knowledge-wise that we don't know. Well, the strange things that I've delivered over the years, when I used to do some of the pet stores, the live crickets that feed some of the animals for the pet stores would be shipped through UPS, so you would hear the crickets going off in the back of the truck when the doors were closed because, you know, it's nice and dark inside the trucks. And I delivered to a body waxing shop on my routes. It always tends to make the girls there happy when they get their supply of wax in. The most dangerous part of my job over my 25 years has been dealing with the dogs. Once I got bit by a German Shepherd, but the Chihuahuas, those dogs are just relentless. Oh yeah, once I had two Chihuahuas come at me. Same house, two of them, and the grandfather opened the house, and one's on my ankle, one's biting my hand, and I don't want to, you know, hurt the dogs. And then the daughter comes out, a young girl, and she's like, please don't kick my dog, please don't. I'm like, okay, just hurry up and get him off. So they would get one off my hand, put the one down that was getting on my hand, grab the one on my ankle, and then the one would be back on my ankle. So it went on for like literally 15 minutes. This route pays around $80,000 to $85,000 a year. You know, we see the habits, you know, just in that short time that we drive by. You know, it's like I know most all my customers by name, and lots of them know me by name.
Thank you, everybody.
They consider us, you know, part of their landscape.
Fingers. Have a good day.
That was UPS driver Fred Gorley. Check out our website for pictures of him and maybe the dogs in action. It's marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was produced by Shireen Meraji. When a family declares, we're not buying gifts this year, you might think, total bummer holiday. But they do have things to give.
I don't think it's the idea of not giving gifts. It's the kind of gifts that you're giving.
That story's next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Finished your holiday shopping yet? Now, this is supposed to be a big discount weekend as retailers desperately try to lure you to the mall. They're desperate because it seems lots of folks are scaling back on the annual gift orgy. Some are doing more than that. They're not buying gifts at all. They're getting into the holiday spirit without going into debt. Janae Darden has that story.
Thousands of needy people are lined up at a Salvation Army center in South Los Angeles.
We got food on this side,
yes,
too.
Yes, this is food. And this is food on this
side?
Yeah,
we're going to do two lines.
Of course, but I just... the rest of-
Volunteer director Amina Patterson is getting her team ready to hand out holiday baskets. This year, Patterson's family is doing Christmas a little different. There will be a tree, just no gifts underneath it.
I think that with all that's going on in society and, you know, the fact that we have been very blessed, we should bless some people on Christmas rather than sitting at home in our beautiful home and opening gifts.
Patterson and her husband decided their family would feed the hungry instead of giving presents. That also means no gifts for their two children.
They have bikes. They have three game systems at home. And we just said enough.
Patterson's kids are helping with volunteer registration. Her daughter, Aladia, is 9. Son, Amir, is 12. He says the news of no gifts caught him off guard.
Well, when she first said it to me, she said it with a smile. So I kind of thought, oh, yeah, funny, Mom. You're joking around with me. So then she said, no, I'm serious. And then she explained it to me and what we would be doing. And I was like, that's pretty cool.
Another cool thing,
the amount of money they'll save. Patterson says she usually spends about $3,000 for Christmas gifts. Of course, a free and festive holiday means getting creative. We're talking homemade presents. But can a gift from the heart really top a Nintendo Wii?
I don't think it's the idea of not giving gifts. It's the kind of gifts that you're giving.
Karen Hudson is an advice columnist for the Los Angeles Wave. She says a valuable gift doesn't have to cost a fortune. Hudson is thinking outside the box for her mother's present.
I'm retyping her phone book in big letters and just putting in a 3-ring binder and giving it to her.
Did your mother do your hair? Did she send you to a hairdresser?
Hairstylist Marva Carmichael stopped buying Christmas gifts in 1977. That's the year her pastor suggested another way to celebrate the holiday.
We figure since Jesus is not here, what better way to give gifts to Jesus than to help others? Why would I give my kids gifts? They have everything. My sisters have everything.
So she gives the gift of time, helping kids whose parents are incarcerated. Another message she took from that sermon, serving others can be a service to your wallet.
That's one of the things the pastor would say. If you start celebrating Christmas this way, just think of the money you would save.
Tell that to Shanita Woods, a nursing assistant in San Diego. Her family decided no Christmas dinner this year, and they canceled their traditional $100 gift exchange.
One of my daughters was having a real hard time financially, so I said to take the pressure off of her, let's just forget it this year. We can go without, you know, doing something. Actually, I was going to still get all my kids a pack of underwear. You know something. Everybody's going to get a little $4 or $5 gift, you know.
Luckily, Santa came a little early for her daughter.
She found out recently that she's getting a big bonus, and so she was back into the Christmas spirit.
The Woods family is still cutting back for Christmas. Dinner is back on, but the gift exchange limit is down to $25. In Los Angeles, I'm Janae Darton for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriven.com. And by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. You can join the conversation at Gather.com. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
All right, we're back with more Getting Personal, and with me once again is Chris Farrell. And Chris, we have Charles on the phone. Hi, Charles.
Hi.
Before we get started, how do I pronounce the name of your city? Powhatan, Arkansas?
Depends. How old are you? The young folks pronounce it Powhatan. The old folks pronounce it Powhatan.
All right. Well, I'm a youngster, so I'm going to go with Powhatan. Well, I understand that you're looking to possibly start investing as we see that stocks are in a bit of a bargain basement right now. What are you looking to buy?
I wouldn't mind getting hold of a few shares of maybe Harley-Davidson or something to that effect. Things that I like that have been around for a long time that I don't think are just going to be, you know, here today and gone tomorrow.
Well, there's just so much risk associated with buying individual stocks. I mean, I just really do have to say that. And things seem low, but they could go even lower.
Mm-hmm.
So I just really do want to put out there, when you don't have much money, I really love things like treasury bills and FDIC insured bank accounts and certificates of deposit and all that kind of stuff where there's no risk and you know the money's going to be there a year from now.
Boring but safe.
Boring but safe. Yeah, that's my motto.
Right. Well, that's my other conundrum is, see, I don't have enough money to put into a CD. I don't have enough money to put into a T-bill. How can I go and buy, say, 5 or 10 shares of this or 5 or 10 shares of that if I felt like doing it?
There are some online companies like ShareBuilder.com, which allow you to do exactly what you're talking about. Minimal stock purchases, no real minimums there. And the other route that people have gone is dividend reinvestment plans, where instead of getting the dividend payment, you end up with more shares in the company. It's a way of building it up over time. But I really, you know, think buying individual stocks is fun, but it's play money. In your circumstances where we're talking, you know, we don't have much money and I'm sure you need the money, you know, I think you do much better going with just simply an online savings account or something like that. because really it's not the rate of interest you get, it's that the money is safe.
Yeah, a lot of it would be that, you know, I'm not looking to get rich off of it, but it would be nice to give each of my children a stock of Harley-Davidson and maybe a stock of IBM and maybe a stock of GE.
You know what? If that's what you want to do, go check out ShareBuilder.com.
Yeah.
And one benefit, I think, of ShareBuilder is even if you don't have enough money to buy a full share of a company, you can buy, like, part of a share. You can just determine what amount you want to put into that company, and then it buys you whatever percentage of the share that you want. So, but again, as Chris said, it should be a little bit of play money, and you don't want to put money in the stock market that you can't lose.
Right. And it's just like when you go to the casino. Don't take money that you don't expect to lose.
That's exactly right.
Well, I really appreciate listening to y'all's show on Saturdays. I'm a rural mail carrier part-time and try to listen to you guys every Saturday, so I really appreciate it.
Well, wonderful. Thanks so much for the call. All right, Chris, next we have another stock question, and this is via email from Corwin in Cleveland, Ohio. He is confused as to why and how people are still buying and selling Lehman Brothers stock. I'm confused, too. This is a bankrupt company.
Right.
Their quotes online indicate some sort of dividend. So here's a question from Corwin. Why? And a bonus, he will gladly buy us a round of Lehman Brothers stock for an answer.
Very nice.
I don't know that we really want
it. Nice is going to say, you know, gee, thanks for that kind of an offer, but we'll still answer your question.
Okay.
Last time I looked, 4 cents a share. Now, the dividend payment, what that is from, in the third quarter, Lehman Brothers made its last dividend payment. It's not making a dividend payment right now.
No.
In fact, essentially, the company is being dismembered. There's no value there. I guess this is people just having fun. You know, maybe some wild, crazy thought that perhaps there's going to be some residual value at the end. But here's the bottom line. When a company goes into bankruptcy, and this was the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history, extremely complicated bankruptcy, shareholders are wiped out. They're wiped out. Whatever value there is resides with the bondholders.
All right, Corwin, we will be expecting our 4 cent stock certificates in the mail. Thank you so much. And let's take another email from Chad. He says he and the kitchen staff at the Hotel Winneshiek in Decorah, Iowa, they listen to us every Saturday, and we make the weekend shift tolerable.
Oh, that's great.
And Chad is a new uncle, and he wants to give a gift of $250 to the new arrival. He wants to know what the smartest thing is to do with that money. Chris, I'm going to guess, based on your track record, you're going to suggest
529
plan. Yep.
Yes. Now, first of all, call up the proud parents and say that you'd like to give a little bit of money. And are they thinking about opening a 529 plan, which is very easy for them to do?
And this is a college savings plan.
It's a college savings plan, and anybody can contribute to this plan. So it typically, a lot of times, family members do. And one of the things that we're seeing in the environment that we're in, and hopefully this sort of sticks just past the environment where people are trying to give gifts that last as opposed to gifts that get thrown away a year or two later. So this is a gift that lasts or pays for something really valuable, college. You know, so they open up the 529 plan, you put it in there, compounds tax-free. When the child goes to college, cashes it in, pays for qualified educational expenses, tax-free. What a deal. That is a real deal.
Okay, so there you go. I knew it. I knew it, my friend.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we've got for this week's show, but we are here for you pretty much all the time in one way or another. Chris answering questions each weekday on his blog, Getting Personal, and you can find that at marketplace.org. And while you're there, send us an email with a question of your own. You can also call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And thanks, as always, for the great advice, Chris, and very happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Not to put a lump of coal in your stocking, but Santa is not the only guy you should be focusing on at the end of December. The tax man needs to be in the mix there. You have until December 31st to make any last-minute tax maneuvers for 08, And this year, more than most, we are all looking for helpful hints to make up for a dismal year. So once again, we've brought in Tom Herman, tax columnist for The Wall Street Journal. And Tom, you know, so many people are looking at the absolute devastation in their IRA balances, their 401ks, their stock market investments. What kinds of year-end strategies should they be employing to get maybe at least a little help from Uncle Sam?
Those losses are really painful, but if you were thinking of selling some of those anyway, now is a very good time to consider pulling the trigger. They can be used to cut your taxes for 2008. There are basically two rules you should keep in mind. Number one, you can use your losses to offset your gains on a dollar-for-dollar basis, and there's no limit on that. So if you had a $10,000 gain earlier this year, you could now sell some stocks for a $10,000 loss, put the two together, and you'd save the tax on the $10,000 gain. You'd have a net loss of zero. But there's one other very important rule that a lot of readers I've found do not know about. Suppose your losses are even bigger than your gains. In that case, you can sell those losers and deduct up to $3,000 of your net losses each year from your wages and other ordinary income. The limit is only $1,500 if you're married and filing separately, but most people can deduct up to $3,000 of their net losses from their salary. That's a very valuable thing to have.
Is there anything special that you can do if you owned stock in, say, Lehman Brothers or IndyMac or Washington Mutual that are now essentially penny stocks or worse?
Well, there are special rules for stocks that are completely worthless, but keep in mind that just because a company goes into bankruptcy proceedings, that doesn't mean the stock is totally worthless. If your stock is trading for, say, pennies a share, what I frequently recommend is go to a trusted broker and have the broker agree to buy that stock from you for some nominal amount. That way you can book your loss for tax purposes. There's no doubt what the amount was because that's what you got on that day and you have the loss.
And what if you own something that is quite literally worthless?
If it's worthless and it became worthless this year, you can deduct it on your Schedule D. That's the form you file with your tax return and there's a place for it and you just put the amount of your terrible loss in a parenthesis on Schedule D. But just be sure it's totally worthless.
Is there any relief for the hundreds of thousands of people who have watched their property values plummet? Anything in the tax code that can help those folks?
Unfortunately, you cannot take a loss on the sale of your home. That surprises a lot of people. A lot of people think of their home as their primary investment.
Right.
But that does not count.
Here's another very complicated twist that I wonder if you could help us sort through this. I've been reading that with some mutual funds, you could actually find yourself subject to capital gains even if you've taken big hits. How is that possible?
Absolutely. And this amazes investors when they find this out. You could have invested in a mutual fund that's down 40 or 50% this year, and you could still get a capital gains distribution from that fund. And a lot of people can't figure out why that is.
I'm among them, so help us out.
The basic reason is that a lot of mutual funds sold stocks much earlier in the year when prices were much higher because they wanted to move to a different type of stock or they just thought that stock was heading down. So they have these built-in capital gains, and they didn't want to sell later, so they may have big capital gains distribution that they're paying out. Mutual funds are required by law to make these capital gains distributions. Most of those distributions come in December. So the advice is, if you're thinking about diving into a stock market mutual fund right now, don't do it unless you check with that fund first. Call the fund or check its website and see if the fund is about to make a big capital gains distribution. If it is, consider investing in another fund briefly or find another fund. Otherwise, you're in effect going to be getting back some of your own money. It's like paying someone else's tax bill.
And what we're talking about here is taxable accounts, right? This does not affect 401ks, IRAs, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. This is only for your taxable accounts. And I should have mentioned earlier that you can't deduct losses in your retirement accounts. These are only for taxable accounts.
Okay. And no AMT worries this year, right? They've already dealt with that?
There are still very definitely AMT worries, but the level of worry will only be the same as last year. It's not going to soar. If the Congress had done nothing this year, the number of people who are ensnared by the alternative minimum tax would have gone from about 4 million to 26 million. That's why Congress stepped in and made some changes in the alternative minimum tax rules. So this year there will still be somewhere around 4 million people caught up by the AMT. It's likely to undergo major changes, but not until next year at the earliest.
All right. So just to review, what's the most important thing to think about tax-wise as you're preparing for April 2009?
The two most important would be consider dumping some of the stocks that are down in value and use those losses to cut your tax bill. The other one would be consider last-minute charitable donations. That's a great way to cut your taxes as long as you're doing what's called itemizing your deductions instead of taking the standard deduction.
Tom Herman is the tax columnist for The Wall Street Journal and a good friend of the program. Thanks so much. It was great talking to you again, and Happy New Year.
Thanks, Tess. You too.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, some post-holiday economic lessons from literature.
When credit dries up completely, you have a Scrooge situation in which Scrooge has a lot of money. He just sits on it.
Marketplace Money is produced by Jim Wallace, Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. To those of you who are celebrating them this week, we wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy Hanukkah.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriven.com.
American Public Media.